Week 3 in the NFL was unforgettable. The anthem demonstrations took the headlines, but the games were absolutely unbelievable. We'll talk Tom Brady's epic comeback to steal one from Deshaun Watson. Lions lose by inches on a technicality. A rookie kicker lifts the Eagles. It was a day of upsets. The NFL at its best. We're breaking it all down on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. Andy, that was as fun a day of football as I can remember. That was completely unforgettable.
I agree. And that's what's fun about the NFL. A lot of, I guess you'd call them upsets. We go through and we look at, like the Bears, for example. We looked at their schedule a week in advance, and, oh, they've got the Steelers come up, and then later on it's whoever, and the Ravens later. They're not going to score any points. And look what happens with the Bears. Look what happens to the Ravens in London. The NFL, it's such a fine line between good and bad and good and great. And that line is constantly moving. I've always said, if you don't bring your best game each week, you will get beat in the NFL.
Yeah, and it was sort of a testament to, and degenerate gamblers like me and my family members could tell you this, there were, on Sunday, there were 8 home underdogs, 6 of them won outright. So it's sort of a testament to how difficult it is to win on the road in this league, no matter what the matchup may be. But we'll get to all the games right now. They were, like I said, just a series of classics. We're also going to have a little talk about the anthem demonstrations, which obviously were a huge moment for the league and kind of for society as a whole. We'll talk about that later in the show. But we are going to start with the football and what happened when the clock was running between the lines. And we'll start with topic number one. That was the Patriots and the Texans.
Number one.
This was one that was supposed to be a blowout, and the Texans nearly escaped Foxborough with a win again. The Tom Brady comeback was incredible in this one, not just because it was, you know, late in the game and you got to come back, and it was a game where the Patriots offensive line was once again being just absolutely dominated by the Texans pass rush, but he got sacked twice on that last drive, and they still got it. They still got the touchdown they needed.
Yeah, kind of a game of extremes. Everyone on both sides, the stars played to their best. Houston's defense made plays. We talked all offseason about how well Houston matches up to New England. And then Tom Brady made plays. And there is no defensive scheme that can account for near-perfect quarterbacking. And Tom Brady right now, Gary, this started at the beginning of that Saints game last week. And when I went back and watched that film, I was in awe. That was the best, the beginning of the Saints game, those first three drives. That was the best three-drive sequence that I've ever seen Tom Brady have. You could argue he is playing the best football of his career right now, these last 2 weeks, and it carried over into this game on Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah, on that last drive, he took sacks. They faced a 2nd and 20 at one point. They faced a 3rd and 18 at one point. And amazingly, they didn't even face a 4th down after all that. So it's not even like the kind of thing where, well, they had the extra down, so they got half of it and then got the rest. This was a traditional, almost mid-game scoring drive, except for the urgency. And obviously, it ends with the connection with Brandon Cooks. Big impact for Brandon Cooks in this one. And it looks like the Patriots, even though their offensive line wasn't great against a very good pass rush, they are sort of pulling it together offensively here. The story of the game, had Brady not made the comeback, and it's almost still the story of the game anyway, was Deshaun Watson's play and the fact that he had the Patriots on their heels pretty much the entire game. I had written that I did not think Deshaun Watson was ready, and I thought it might be detrimental to his development to be in the starting lineup right now, and that certainly seems to be an incorrect take at this point.
How's Deshaun Watson feel about it?
I got a little note from Deshaun Watson. Wasn't a rude note, but he dropped me a little note to say thanks for the column type of thing. So I am now officially one of his doubters, I suppose. I didn't doubt him. I don't think he's like a long-term bust or something. I just said I don't think he's ready right now. And based on the first 6 quarters he played, I think that's not even really a bold stance I was taking. I just thought it was too early for him, and I thought it was going to be worse for him in the long run to be on the field at this point in his career, before he's ready.
Yeah, it's hard to game plan against mobile quarterbacks, young ones, that you don't know what they're going to do. It's interesting. A few years ago, Gary, I asked coaches around the NFL. This was right after the Broncos-Seahawks Super Bowl. So Manning was at his height, and Kaepernick was still relatively close to his height. And I asked a ton of coaches, at least a dozen, who would you rather play against, Manning or Kaepernick? And all of them, who I think all of them would vehemently say Manning's the better quarterback, but a lot of them wanted to still play against Manning. The reason is coaches hate unpredictability. And when you get mobile quarterbacks, you create unpredictability. And if you don't have a lot of film on those guys yet, if they're still relatively new, and Kaepernick at that point, it was after 2013, so he had a year and a half under his belt. It's still relatively new. It's hard to know how to scheme for them. Over time, their weaknesses show, and so you can narrow your scheme. But most defensive concepts are built around the idea of a stationary quarterback, because if you don't have that, you're just guessing. You can't design a pass rush that attacks a moving target. The game's too fast. It's too much guesswork involved. And so you have to kind of just survive these mobile QBs until you see enough film on them that you can isolate the exact things they do and do not do well. And they do so many things that it's hard to isolate everything right away. And maybe we're seeing a little bit of that with Deshaun Watson. It's also possible he's going to be a really good player. But yeah, he is, you're right. I mean, he's not totally ready. It was evident on film against the Bengals. He's been thrown in there. He's a young guy in a hard offense. He didn't have very many reps in camp because he was the number two. You said nothing wrong about Watson. That doesn't mean he's not going to have success, though, in the short term, because he's just such a unique player.
Yeah, I mean, look, they had a lot of bells and whistles. Bill O'Brien had a great game plan in this game. A lot of bells and whistles. A lot of, you know, they did a lot of design runs. They had a lot of, you know, they did some fly sweep stuff. They always had someone, they always had some sort of unique look coming off the snap there. A lot of first down throws. And look, the Patriots were on their heels. And, you know, if you're on your heels against a guy like Watson, who, I mean, he made a couple of just incredible escapes and extending plays and doing things with his legs that were absolutely special. I mean, the drive where they almost clinch it, they were a yard from clinching this game on the final drive there and not putting the ball back in Brady's hands. They end up getting stopped on a 3rd-and-1, kicked the field goal. But there was a play that got that drive going where, I mean, he got out of one guy's grasp. Two other guys collided trying to tackle him, and he got away and flipped it to, I think it might have been Ryan Griffin. It might have been one of the fullbacks, though, who ends up running it for, you know, a very long catch and run on what was a sort of a playground type of play. But that was the kind of stuff you saw. He also, you know, traditionally he beat Devin McCourty twice. He had a nice little, you know, one touchdown play was, you know, McCourty was single high and he looked him away over to the left sideline and then got Bruce Ellington up the seam. And then there was a back shoulder throw to Ryan Griffin, who was being covered well by McCourty in the end zone where you know, Watson got McCourty again. So that's a pretty good guy to get twice, because Devin McCourty is really good.
No question about it. And they use him really well there in New England. And he's often been a big part of stopping mobile quarterbacks. In the Super Bowl against Seattle, he was the lurk defender in their man-lurk concept. So man-to-man, deep safety, and then a free lurking defender in the shallow middle of the field. That was McCourty that game to keep eyes on Russell Wilson. And you wonder if New England maybe wishes they'd done that a little bit more. And we'll have to go back and see how often they did it. But that's the kind of stuff you have to do to adjust to these mobile QBs. Even mobile QBs who throw, they still throw from different launching points at times. So you have to put eyes on them in unique ways.
Yeah. Yeah, this is quite a performance. Obviously, Texans fans should be very excited. You might have a quarterback to go along with your defense. And, yeah, I will admit there's a 98.4% chance I was wrong. Not 100%, though. We'll see what happens going forward now that this stuff's on film. They'll have to expand things a little bit, and it's still a lot to put on his plate. But, obviously, he was absolutely special in this game, and he might be absolutely special going forward here. But let's stop talking about my stupidity and move on to topic number two.
Number two.
This was the Falcons hold on in Detroit. And before we talk about it, I'll just throw this out here, Andy. The way this game ended was Golden Tate, Lions are down 4. Stafford hits Golden Tate on a little slant. It looks like he's in for the game-winning touchdown in the final seconds. They call it a touchdown on the field. Lions have no timeouts left. They review it and decide it is not a touchdown because the Lions had no timeouts left. The rule is that they run off 10 seconds because they don't want to give a team a free timeout on the review. That ran off the final 8 seconds of the clock. Ball gets put on the four-inch line. Game is over. Falcons hold on. I can't think of a better solution than that. I mean, I don't know if there's a more fair way to do it, and I don't know if I'm just not thinking of something.
No, that's the it's the correct solution. This isn't an opinion-based ad. This conversation with Peter King, because I was going to maybe write about the Lions-Falcons, and I called him and said, I mean, the ending's the story of the game, and there's no opinion to be had there. There's a right and a wrong here, and the right answer is the one the league has in place already, which is you do that 10-second runoff if you lose a challenge, because otherwise Detroit, or if you lose the replay review, otherwise Detroit, they're not going to be able to line up and run another play in 8 seconds anyway, so they gain an unfair advantage from the review, even if the review goes against them, and that's wrong. The Falcons won the game. They stopped Golden Tate at the one-inch line. If there'd been no review and they'd gotten the call right there on the field, they still would have won the game. So that was fine. I was glad. It was a great ending. In fact, I watch these on DVR, Gary, and I get through them as quick as I can because I've got to cram so much into a Sunday. And so I fast forward through the reviews, and so I wrote down in my notes, Detroit's won the game. Here's how they did it. They beat Brian Poole on a rub route, good coverage, better offense. And I'm starting to put away my stuff, and I fast forward through, and I thought, wait, where's the kickoff? They still had 8 seconds left. Aren't they supposed to kick off still? And that's how I found out Detroit lost the game. I've never had a game end, and I've gotten the ending wrong watching it on television right there in front of me. It was a lot of fun, but I was glad Detroit. What's that?
I was going to say it would have been a bizarre article to turn in how the Lions beat the Falcons.
Seriously, I was also relieved I caught it, because what if I had sat down and spent the next 2 hours writing the story?
Yeah,
I mean that would have derailed. Well, I don't know what you do on a Sunday when you write a story that's wrong on the ending. So I was lucky that I saw it. Because if I'm watching on DVR, I'm also not looking at scores of other games during this. So it could have very well been Sunday Night Football before I realized what I'd done. I was glad that Detroit lost and Atlanta won, though, because over the course of that whole game, and this gets lost because of the ending, Atlanta dominated Detroit. And they had three interceptions, two of them off tip balls. One of the tips was a less-than-ideal throw by Matt Ryan, so you can put that on him. And then the Glover Quinn interception for a touchdown that Ryan threw early, that was great defense, and he beat the quarterback. So it wasn't a perfect game by Atlanta, but the rest of it, you take out those three plays, the down-to-down flow of the game, Atlanta dominated. Detroit's linebackers, they were without Jared Davis. There was a noticeable drop-off there. Atlanta had a field day running between the tackles with Freeman, running to the perimeter with Tevin Coleman. That's their foundation. Mm-hmm. It was a really good game by the Falcons. It was one they absolutely deserved to win.
No, I agree 100%. I mean, if you're the Falcons, you have to be thrilled that you just had a game where you had three turnovers. And like you said, defense makes a play on a turnover, but two of those were tip balls. So it's kind of like a series of bad breaks for the Falcons, but they still end up beating a quality team on the road. And like you said, I mean, look, I was keeping a close eye on this game, and there was a sense, I think, right up until the fourth quarter when the Falcons sort of had to get a little conservative and try and run some clock, there was a sense that they weren't going to be stopped, that they were just going to march down the field every time they had the ball. They had 10 drives, granted three of them were turnovers, and one was the end of half, but so let's call it 9 full drives before they had to punt. They didn't have to punt the ball until 3:33 left in the fourth quarter. So this was an impressive performance by the Falcons. Lions are a good team, but the Falcons were definitely the better team in this game.
Yeah, and Lions, they should be encouraged too, because they're a very simple defense, a lot of too high, straight up zone coverage. If you're going to play that, you need to be generating turnovers, and they did not do that a year ago. That was an issue. They have been doing it this season, and again, they did. Those were three legitimate intercepts. One was a Mohamed Sanu drop, but the other one, the one off Tevin Coleman's hands, that gets probably chalked up as Tevin Coleman dropping it, drop tip interception. But Matt Ryan was a tad off target because he was rushed and off schedule in the pocket. It's still good defense generating the bad offense. That's what Detroit's scheme is designed to do, and they're starting to do it more regularly now.
Absolutely.
Number 3.
But let's jump ahead to topic number three, and this was the Titans beating the Seahawks in Nashville. Ultimately, this was a game where the Titans' run game just sort of took this one over. I guess you'd say, would you say that was the story of this one, Andy? Because I know you had a very close eye on this game.
Well, yes, and that's 2 weeks in a row now for Tennessee's running. Tennessee has won these last two games by playing the exact kind of football they're built to play. They smash mouth, run the ball against you. They line up in heavy personnel and even do it. So two tight ends, or in this case, they did a lot of six offensive linemen with Kelly, the former Eagle, as that six lineman. And fullbacks on the field. Derrick Henry was very productive running behind a fullback a week ago. And this one is DeMarco Murray was more the guy. He had a nice game. But they're wearing teams down. And so their second half running game has been dominant against Jacksonville and now Seattle. Two very similar defenses, two very talented defenses. I haven't seen a team just line up and take it to the Seahawks in the second half the way they did.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I think, like you wrote in your article, your Russell Wilson article that came out today, you know, that the heat and humidity in Nashville was oppressive in this one. And gosh, when you got to be out on the field against this run game for 33 minutes, that's tough to handle for any defense, even one as good as the Seahawks are.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'm actually surprised. I'm looking at the snap count. Both teams had 73 snaps. It did not feel that way. They were different types of snaps. And Seattle accumulated some at the end in comeback mode, and Russell Wilson played really well in their comeback mode. And I think, Gary, the conversation now shifts to what does Seattle have to become here? Because their own running game is not producing. I know people like Chris Carson, the seventh-round rookie, and he's a feel-good story, and he's an overachiever, and he's a pretty good power runner. We don't know that he's a foundational back, not like Marshawn Lynch, where foundational in that your scheme runs on his shoulders. And it's doubtful that they have the offensive line to ask any running back to do that anyway. So what do they become? Because they clearly have to play around their offensive line. They have to hide their O-line. And that is hard to do because Russell Wilson's not a traditional drop-back pocket-passing QB. So you're limited there. You have to be very creative, and I think we're going to see them putting Wilson on the move by design, which is what you should be doing with him, and then spreading out and throwing quickly like they did at the end of the 2015 season when Pittsburgh came in that December game and Seattle lit them up for, what, I don't know, 500 yards or whatever it was, spreading out and just throwing the ball 1.5 seconds after the snap. I think that becomes their offense eventually.
Yeah. They, I mean, look, people are going to look at what they did today and say, oh, well, Russell Wilson threw for 373 yards, and they had 400-something. What, they have 433 as a team, and, you know, looks like things are great again in Seattle. It's not quite the case. I mean, it's not a, you know, drive-to-drive. They are still having issues.
Correct. And if you're going to be a defensive-built team, you can't be a drive-to-drive offense. Their first seven drives yielded no points, and I believe all of them ended in six plays or less, which is why their defense was on the field so much, and their defense played tired in the second half. They may have finished with only 73 snaps, but so many of them came early in the game that they got killed on those last few snaps. They were giving up such big plays. That's why they were off the field. DeMarco Murray went 75 yards for a touchdown on them. That's only one snap. So their offense does not complement their defense right now, and that's the issue. And it used to be great. That offense with Marshawn Lynch perfectly complemented the defense. Russell Wilson was a complementary player with Lynch as the driving force of the offense. They can't play that way anymore. They don't have the personnel for that. And Wilson's such a unique quarterback, they have to now tailor to him, and they have to hide certain weaknesses of his because he doesn't see well from the pocket. He does a lot of other things really well, and that's what they're going to have to focus on is how to put him on the move, how to get him touch passes where he's great. It's a different-looking Seahawks offense if they do this right.
Number four.
Well, let's hop ahead to the Sunday nighter. This was Raiders and Redskins, and this was the Redskins sort of taking it to Oakland. I think everyone had at least one foot on the Raiders bandwagon going into this game, and not that everyone has to jump off, but this was kind of the first time I can remember, maybe since that Thursday night they played in Kansas City in the freezing cold where Carr had the injured finger. But this is the first time where the Raiders were really overwhelmed with Derek Carr under center.
And I kind of chalk this up to one of just these things happen. This is going to happen once in a while. I'm sure there are a lot of Raider fans who think, I hate Derek Carr, and here I come ready to gloat, told you so, Carr's no good. That's not the case at all. I think Derek Carr is a young, borderline superstar. I think he's played very well this season. He did not play well Sunday night, and nobody on that side of the ball did. Carr wants to take all the blame. That's the right thing to say as the quarterback, but we're not dumb enough to give him all the blame. That was a very collective effort by the Raiders. And let's not overlook Washington. They played extremely well on both sides of the ball. It's a really well-played game by Washington. They fit their profile in that game.
Yeah, I mean, look, they were very physical with the Raiders. You know, they didn't get pushed around like that Oakland offensive line does to a lot of teams. They also, I mean, did they find something that maybe a lot of teams don't do? You know, Collinsworth was talking about, the Redskins were sort of playing, they were playing off coverage, but not soft coverage. They were very quick to be ready to jump on those short timing throws that Carr likes so much, and that's what had him padding the ball a lot.
Yeah, and Oakland has been tremendous in those spread empty sets, and that Pro Football Focus stat and the excellent stat of how quick Carr's been getting the ball out. They showed it at the front of the game, 1.91 seconds on average coming into this game. That number has gone up now, of course. But Oakland has spread out and thrown the ball before you can do anything as a defense. So Washington played the off coverage with the understanding that they are likely to see these spread throws. So we're going to convert our off coverage into tight coverage after the snap, induce the spread throws, and then go attack them. And what they did, they got Oakland out of that spread game. They also took away Oakland's running game. And Gary, this is why, and Raider fans get sensitive about this too, this is why I don't think Oakland's offensive line is in the discussion for best in the league. It's in the discussion as one of the best in the league, but the Raiders don't ask their offensive linemen to win in dominant fashion very often. They are a good run-blocking unit. They will ask them to do that, but it's a lot of double teams. It's a cohesive thing with the offensive line. If those double teams aren't working, then their guys are good players, but maybe not great players. And then in pass protection, almost never does a Raider offensive lineman have to pass protect for a 5 or 7 step drop back. It's either these spread quick throws, or it's your downfield play action game, which oftentimes Lee Smith, their tight end, their blocking tight end, he's on the field helping that downfield play action game. Well, we just said they took away the quick throws in Washington. They beat them in the run game, so there goes your play action element. Now it's third and long, and we're seeing that offensive line got exposed tonight. Washington was better on the edges. They won inside as well. And I don't want to say that's the real Raiders O-line, because they also didn't play up to their usual standards, but that was not the greatest shock in the world. Oakland's offensive line does not get put in those positions very often, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason the Raiders play the way they do, and their O-line got exposed in this one.
Yeah, they did.
I think Washington's got the best O-line in this game. No one talks about that Redskins front five. That's an athletic group. They can do a lot with their screen game with Spencer Long at center and especially Trent Williams at left tackle. They have a good right tackle, Morgan Moses. Most teams have to hide their right tackle. Washington doesn't. That's a really good line they have there.
Well, you know what it is? Just their run game has never put up monster numbers. And part of that has been they've been rotating in kind of, let's call them, second-tier runners behind it. But you know, if you're not a team that is rolling up 140, 150 yards every week, your line kind of doesn't get credit.
Yeah, good point. And one issue that's always stood out, and it did not in this game, Washington, because they're an outside zone stretching team and because they use their tight ends so prominently in a lot of their designs, a lot of times those tight ends get caught in critical blocks in the run game on the edges, and their point of attack run blockers. And Jordan Reed, Vernon Davis, those guys are athletes. They're receiving tight ends. They're not very good blocking tight ends. Davis will compete, though. They'll both compete, but they're not Lee Smith. They're not even Jason Witten of a few years ago, where they can win against defensive ends. So I think that is artificially, or not artificially, but that's just been what has kept their run game in check a little bit, too. It's partly the way the offense is structured.
Absolutely. All right, Andy, before we move on, quick message. Fantasy football fans, listen up. If you love fantasy football, then you need to try my new favorite app, Draft. It's weekly fantasy football, but not like the other guys. On Draft, you play real live snake drafts with other people just like in your season-long league. Here's how it works. It's a draft that lasts for just 1 week, and there's no management. Just set it and forget it. Once you're done drafting, that's it. No trades, no waiver wire. Draft even takes care of last-minute injuries for you. Drafts start every couple minutes, so you can join one right now. And the best part? Play for cold, hard cash. Drafts start for just $1, so there's a draft for everyone. No salary caps. Play in a real live snake draft, just like you play with your friends in a season-long league. Come and join me on Draft today. Download the app anytime. Just search Draft in your app store and join a game in minutes. Or play right from your computer on PlayDraft.com, whatever you want. For a limited time only, all new players get a free entry into Draft when you make your first deposit, but you have to use our promo code 10THINGS, 10THINGS. That's right, play a real money game for free just by using our promo code 10THINGS on your first deposit on Draft. Just search Draft in the App Store or go to PlayDraft.com and come play free with promo code 10THINGS, 10THINGS.
Number 5.
All right, Andy. Topic number 5. This was the classic NFC East rivalry, the Eagles and the Giants. This was a roller coaster here. It, of course, ends with the 61-yarder by Jake Elliott, which it made me very happy. I have a soft spot for kickers. Elliott struggled last week. He's the rookie. He was cut by the Bengals. Eagles picked him up when Caleb Sturgis went down. He missed a chip shot kick in Kansas City last week that maybe changed the flow of that game a little bit. But he comes on for the 61-yarder and nails it. That's how the Eagles won this game. But this was one, I guess let's start with the Giants because it will upset our producer Lou Pellegrino tremendously to have to hear more about the Giants offense. It seems like they finally sort of started to get things going in the second half of this game. One thing, they finally started getting Brandon Marshall the ball where he's sort of facing back towards the line of scrimmage instead of running him on these deep routes, which always just sort of baffled me. But it seems like they're figuring things out. And obviously, Odell Beckham Jr., he's a threat again. And the Eagles had to start adjusting that more and more as the game went on. And that opened up some other things. And I feel like the Giants are sort of, it's not like they're going to be a great offense, but they're getting right offensively. And when you have an elite defense and average offense, I mean, that's still a recipe for winning a lot of games.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's not a coincidence. This was really the first game that Beckham was kind of himself, almost fully healthy and a down-to-down threat this week. And it's also the first game that Brandon Marshall became a regular part of the offense. I don't think those two things are separate. They're very much related. It's a slant-based offense. Marshall is equipped to win on those, but you have to have someone else kind of controlling and influencing the defense in the middle of the field in order to present those slant opportunities. That's the value of Beckham. So the Giants have the right stuff in place now. The problem, Gary, is, you know, you got to be careful about 0-3 records. Like Cincinnati, for example, is 0-3. And people in that town are probably saying, season's over, man, we're already done. Well, the leader in your division is 2-1. So you're 0-3, you're two games out with 13 games to play. Your season's not even close to over. New York is now 3.5 games out because Philadelphia just beat them, and they're 0-3 at the bottom of the NFC East. So I guess Philadelphia is 2-1, so New York's two and a half games out. Yeah, these division losses, though, when you're 0-3 and you're losing within your division, that becomes problematic in the long run. They're in a very big hole now with the Giants.
They are. I mean, look, I wouldn't – they're obviously behind the eight ball. I wouldn't say they're out of it. I think it's in elite defense, and Janoris Jenkins came back today, and that made a big difference. But they were already good defensively. But yeah, it's just kind of, it was a matter of not having Beckham and not having opposing defenses forced to adjust to Beckham. I think this team can go on a run. They started really slow last year. I'm not going to sit here and say like, yeah, oh, they're still winning 11 games and going to the playoffs, because obviously that's a long shot. But I think this is, I mean, who else is 0-3 right now? The Chargers are 0-3, and you figure they're really behind the eight ball in the division that they're in. Browns and Bengals are both 0-3. I guess you could say the Bengals maybe still have a shot. Browns probably not so much. 49ers in a rebuild, probably not a great shot at doing anything out in the NFC West. But You know, I feel like the Giants have, when you have an elite defense, and like I said, if it's an okay offense going forward, which I think it will be, I think that's the kind of team that can start running off a couple wins here.
Yeah, you know, I'm with you. I mean, the more really, it's the point I was making. I guess I should have been saying this: the Chargers, who are screwed, huh? They're the ones that are 0-3 and way gone in their division, 3.5 behind Kansas City now. So I'm with you. Maybe it is a little soon to sound the alarms in New York. It's nice also that Eli Manning did not get sacked this game. I don't think anyone would have predicted that coming in based on the first 2 weeks of the season for either team. Philadelphia's four-man rush has been dominant so far.
Yeah. And to what you said earlier, you know, opening up those slant passes. I mean, that was Sterling Shepard, 77 yards on that long slant catch and run, which put the put the Giants up at that point in the fourth quarter. A ton of fourth quarter points in this game. It was really, I mean, it was an entertaining game. It was an exciting game. It was two rivals, and certainly give plenty of credit to the Eagles here for making plays down the stretch. Wentz hits Alshon Jeffrey on the sideline. Really nice play to set up the chance for that was a 19-yard pass that set up Elliott for a chance for a 61-yarder, and then, of course, the rookie kicker comes through with it.
Yeah, huge. I mean, I was taken aback by that kick. That was pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, the Giants burned a timeout beforehand just to get they originally had Rodgers Cromartie back there to field the short kick and try and run it back, and they called the timeout so they could send Beckham out there to try and field the short kick and run it back, and said it's through the uprights.
Must be that elevation, and Philadelphia's elevation, kicking 61 yards.
Is Philadelphia elevated?
No, not even.
I was going to say.
That's what makes it even more incredible.
Andy, I can't handle your dry takes.
Yeah.
This week melted my brain, so it's just been too much. One bummer note in this game, Darren Sproles suffered a broken arm and a torn ACL. He was... I hope he does try to come back, but I think this might be it for him. I don't know if at age he's 34 now. I don't know if you come back from that at this point. But yeah, I mean, he had an incredible career. He was a ton of fun to watch, and the Eagles will miss him too.
Oh, big time. He was their misdirection piece. They tried to go with Nelson Agholor as that misdirection guy, the swing pass, the play action screen game, all that stuff. They went with that in week one, and really that's not, we'll see. Agholor's a work in progress, and they're going to have to find out even more now, but really that's the Darren Sproles role, and they're going to miss that. I mean, you take that away from their offense, they're already becoming a deeper drop back passing team. Now they almost have to become a deeper drop-back passing team because those misdirection elements are part of your three-step drop-back game, and their three-step drop-back game without Sproles, that's a lot less potent.
Number six.
Well, let's move ahead. Topic number six, this was the Packers. Things were very interesting in Lambeau. Packers fall behind early, end up coming back and winning this one in overtime. I know everyone's been citing this stat since the end of the game, but Aaron Rodgers' first overtime victory in his career, which is just sort of a weird and shocking stat. But
yeah, that is. I don't know if I've heard that.
No, now you have. So finally, Aaron Rodgers accomplishes something in his career, gets that overtime win we were all anticipating here. But we'll start with the Packers side of the ball. Pass protection issues. Rodgers ended up having to do a lot of Aaron Rodgers-y things to pull this one out. Carl Lawson sort of did whatever he wanted against this Packers front five, who was without Bakhtiari, but they did have Brian Bulaga back in this game. And, they couldn't keep the heat off Rodgers, but he ends up making enough plays in this one. No Randall Cobb in this one either, so Geronimo Allison ended up making a couple of big plays. And, it's a survive and win type of game for the Packers against a Bengals team that, like you mentioned a little while ago, is better than most people would consider.
Well, better than their record.
0-3.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, they were a little bit. That Geronimo Allison play in overtime, and this is the first time I've heard Tony Romo as an announcer, and I'm looking forward to that game Thursday night with him calling the Bears-Packers because he announces it almost like a really educated fan. I mean, he was into that, screaming in the middle of the play and asking Jim Nance, "You think this kick goes in or doesn't go in?" I mean, he's a different type of announcer, but he made a great point about that Geronimo Allison. It wasn't a touchdown, but a game-winning catch in overtime.
Yeah.
And he said only about one or two guys in the world can make that throw that Rodgers just made. And it was a deep throw outside against cover two, which is a Bengals staple coverage. And Green Bay attacked it. They had two routes on that side of the field. The inside route occupied the safety just enough to hold him. That kept Allison, who's on the outside route, that opened the window just enough. And the reason that the defense allows those windows to open, I mean, for one, you have to cover the inside guy, but for two, the ball takes so long to travel that far that the window can close by the time the ball arrives. That's arm strength. When we talk about arm strength is important, throwing ability does matter. It's not just, are you a smart QB? Do you have the physical tools? That's the greatest illustration. Romo's right. One or two guys in the world is making that throw. The other one's Matthew Stafford, if we're going, who are the two? And that's the difference in the game for Green Bay is their quarterback could make a throw that was available to them that would not be available to other teams.
Yeah, I mean, he had a couple of just mind-bending throws. And nice for Geronimo Allison. Geronimo Allison had what looked like a very important drop on the Packers game tying drive at the end of regulation. He ends up making a play on the very next throw and then obviously makes a huge play here. Obviously, Aaron Rodgers made a lot of that play happen, but, 72-yard catch and run sets up the field goal. Bengals were better in this game. They were better on both sides of the ball. Certainly a encouraging debut for Bill Lazor.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll see where they go from here. I'll be eager to see how they looked on film with this one and the timing of everything they did offensively.
Yeah.
Number seven.
Let's jump ahead. Topic number seven. This was, look, nobody's safe when you go on the road in the NFL. The Steelers go to Chicago and lose as a touchdown plus favorite against the Bears. I'll say it again, Andy, because I say it every time. The Steelers play crappily on the road. The Steelers always play crappily on the road, and it is becoming problematic.
I don't disagree. And this is... I don't like the analysis I'm about to offer up, and I feel like I have no choice but to make it because the guy that watches film and studies this stuff, this is the exact kind of thing I like to dismiss because I think it's hogwash. But I've come to just accept the fact that about two or three times a year, and probably all of them on the road, the Steelers are just going to lose a game that you thought for sure they would have won. They're just going to not show up by Steelers standards. I don't know why that is, but it's happened so often and so regularly that even the analytical mind of me has to acknowledge the validity of it. It's for whatever reason, there are times each year that the Steelers just do not show up, and this was one of those days.
Yeah. Yeah, on the Bears side, I mean, look, they ran the ball great. Jordan Howard ends up with 138. Tariq Cohen adds 78. That's 220 when you throw in Mike Glennon's four rushing yards. They can't throw the ball. They can't throw the ball because they don't have receivers. And even the most optimistic Mike Glennon fan would say he's probably not a very good starting quarterback. So they can't throw the ball, but they certainly ran it in this one. They also get the Marcus Cooper does the Leon Lett impression on a blocked field goal at the end of the first half, which was kind of the Yakety Sacks highlight of this game. Marcus Cooper actually played a good game outside of that one really boneheaded play. But, yeah, nice win for the Bears here, who let one get away in week one against Atlanta. Or I shouldn't say let one get away, but had a chance to win one and dropped a couple balls on the goal line that would have won it. And now they get a quality win at home over the Steelers. So good for them.
Yeah, they are one drop touchdown, really two drop touchdowns in week one away from being 2-1 and having beaten the Steelers and the Falcons at home in Chicago. And imagine what you just said about Mike Glennon, that comment probably never gets made if this team is 2-1. We're talking about them being a darling, a surprise team, NFL, you never know what you get. One thing to keep in mind is Chicago's a little bit of a challenging place to play. What the Falcons and Steelers have in common, they are spread, fast-paced offenses. With the, if they want to be, they don't always spread out. Mm-hmm. But the point is, they can beat you by design with their wide receivers. And the Bears' field is probably the slowest surface in the NFL. And I'm not an arborist or whatever a grass expert is called.
Grass expert.
Yeah. What do you know? What a grass expert's called? Like who? What's the guy
who runs the field?
What's his actual?
It's the Scott's lawn guy. Feeds a lawn.
Oh, that's what it is.
Just gave them a free.
I don't know why it is, but the Bears have a softer, slower field than everybody else, and that can change the look of your offense a little bit, especially if you're like the Steelers or the Falcons and you're built around Julio Jones, Le'Veon Bell, Antonio Brown, Devontae Freeman, those type of players.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't have an answer. I don't think there's a such thing as a grass expert. I guess it'd be like a miniature arborist. Grass is
there's got to be
trees.
Someone will somebody can tweet us. There's a name for a grass expert.
I'm sticking with mini arborists. I'm going to argue that grass is just a series of tiny trees, which is it sounds scientifically accurate to me. So I will go mini arborist.
All right, and whoever, somebody please tweet us or contact us at Andy_Benoit, or what is yours again? You got those letters in there.
Gramling_SI.
Gramling_SI. Someone let us know what we're missing.
Yeah, or just confirm that I am correct. Either way.
Number eight.
Topic number eight. Let's go to London. Let's talk London game, which seems like it happened years ago at this point, considering the events of today. But, you know, it's funny. Obviously, the Jaguars were utterly dominant in this game. It ends up being a 44-7 win over the Ravens. And these teams are so similar, and it was kind of like, you know, if either team jumps out here, the opponent will be incapable of mounting a comeback because of the style each team plays. And sure enough, Jaguars jump out. Things get a little bit simpler for Blake Bortles, and the Ravens can't, you know, they can't put points on the board.
The Ravens have a problem. This is getting problematic. That offense has not done anything in 3 weeks. I mean, it's done nothing. I've been saving their film for like Saturday night late because I know that that's where my brain power is at the worst, and that's my best chance with Baltimore. Yeah, I drifted off on the last Ravens game, their Browns film, the last 10 plays. That offense has nothing going right now. And remember, we talked about they became a gap scheme run team in week one. Well, in week two, they became an outside zone running team again, which I don't know the last time I saw a team run two totally different styles of running games back to back like that. And I don't know what they did, and I didn't see this one live, so I'll have to see the film and what they did this week. But that's an offense that's built to run the ball, and they don't have a running identity.
Yep, they don't have a very good offensive line right now either. Marshall Yanda is out, but on top of that, they were sort of, you know, living on the edge anyway with the talent they have up front. I mean, look, when you lose a game 44-7, I don't have to tell you the statistics are ugly. Flacco ends up 1.56 yards per attempt, which I don't think I've ever seen a number that low in a full game in the NFL. I'm sure it's happened, but that's really bad. And when you throw 18 times and you get 28 yards out of it. This was a blowout. Jaguars defense, kind of like they did week one, really like they did week one and kind of like they did week two before they sort of wore down in Nashville, they were dominant. I mean, it looks like the Jaguars have hit on Calais Campbell and A.J. Bouye and last year Malik Jackson, and they have a really good unit.
Absolutely, and their young guys are playing fast. Miles Jack, Jalen Ramsey, Telvin Smith's always fast. Ngakoue, a defensive end. That's a good team. That's a really good defense. We'll put it that way.
Yeah.
We'll see what you get from the offense. But we know their profile. They're in such a better spot than Baltimore because both teams are built to play the same way, and Jacksonville's actually doing it. They're built to win with defense, some defensive playmaking, and then offensive smash-mouth football. That's what Baltimore wishes they were the Jaguars right now, and they are miles behind where Jacksonville is.
Number nine.
Speaking of playing fast, Andy, topic nine, the lightning is round. We have arrived. Let's start out in L.A., Chiefs, Chargers. Look, another solid win by the Chiefs. Phillip Rivers picked off three times. This was, I mean, look, the final was 24-10. The Chargers hung around, though, and you know, it was a one-possession game for most of the fourth quarter, and or I should say most of the second half, and the Chargers just couldn't make a play, which is, I guess, the story of the Los Angeles Chargers.
Remember last week I was worried about their coach's film angle? I said, where will it look in the stadium? Is it going to look like Soldier Field? Well, the verdict is in, because I got to it. The overhead is fine. It's a little bit low, but I actually kind of like that. You can see the players and their numbers a little easier. So I was pleasantly surprised. Then it flips to the end zone angle, which never is an issue. Some teams have it a little bit low on the ground, not quite tilted up enough, but it's always the end zone angle. Theirs is angled. Like, it's an actual angle, end zone angle. It's not straight on behind the center. It's like tilted behind the right guard's back hip or something weird. It's a different, I couldn't believe it. So, and ironically, the only other team that's ever had that was the Chargers whenever the ball was inside the 20 at their old stadium at Qualcomm. Now their new one, the soccer stadium, it's got it like the whole way. It's a bad, it's a weird end zone angle. There's the verdict on the Chargers coaches film.
Bringing a new tradition, or bringing an old tradition to the new stadium, I guess. Obviously, another great win for the Chiefs. Kareem Hunt seals it. They are doing things offensively, and obviously, you know, the pass rush is playing big-time football, and the Chiefs are really good, in case that was something that was in doubt for people. But jumping ahead, Broncos-Bills. This game, great win for the Bills. If you're a Broncos fan, you kind of watch this, and you hope it you can just chalk it up to a bad day, but this almost looked like the problems of the 2016 Broncos sort of rearing their head in this one. Bills kind of picked on those linebackers and safeties in the middle of the field in the pass game. And Trevor Siemian and the Denver passing game, just not very good in this one. They got beat by the Bills secondary.
And what's a little bit unsettling is Denver ran the ball 23 times for 111 yards.
Yeah. I should say that was actually the Broncos' biggest problem on offense last year.
Right, they're built to that's how they're built to play. I mean, that's not a dominant running performance, but that's their longest run was 32 yards. That's a sustainable run game, and they should be winning games when they have a sustainable run game. That's how they're built to win. So this is a little bit of an unsettling loss for Denver. Buffalo's been good defensively the last few weeks too. That's easy to overlook, but they took it to Carolina. They played their the Sean McDermott staple zone coverages, and here's exactly what McDermott does every week. It's zone coverage, and he blitzes very aggressively and creatively about six or seven times. He does it just enough to keep you off balance. He'll show you blitz looks to influence your protections as well. They're looking like a Sean McDermott defense already there in Buffalo. And keep in mind, they don't have great players yet. And they have very much, they have a whole a retooled secondary across the board. Some of those guys would have been backups, have been backups on previous teams. They're getting it done defensively in what's really a rebuilding year.
Vikings-Bucks, we said some things that can't be taken back about Case Keenum. And Case Keenum went out and made some plays. Now, Vikings scored a ton of points. And look, the Vikings are elite defensively, so you don't have to have a great offensive performance to win. Vikings put up a lot of points early. A lot of it was their receivers making plays. Keenum put him in position to make plays. There was sort of a lot of throw him open type of things and catch and run plays by guys like Stephon Diggs. And if you're the Bucks, you have to be kind of worried. No Brent Grimes in this one, and they look thin in the secondary.
When you're getting catch and run and throw them open plays, it's also a sign of a really well-developed offense, because you can't throw a guy open unless you're throwing within the context of the play design. And Minnesota. I thought New England, because Minnesota's done a lot of the New England Patriots stuff the first few weeks. They've been really well designed under Pat Shurmur. Their stack releases, their crossing routes at out leverage coverage, their route combinations. Tampa Bay is a predictable zone defense, and when Minnesota saw that in week one against New Orleans, they carved them up. Well, they carved up another predictable zone defense here in this game. Really good start to the season for Pat Shurmur, their offensive coordinator in Minnesota.
Yeah. Good things for the Vikings again. You know, be nice to have Sam Bradford back, but clearly they can win some games without him, I guess. Saints-Panthers, this was, look, Drew Brees, we haven't talked about a whole lot because the Saints haven't been very good first couple weeks of the season. Drew Brees has been fantastic, though, and he was amazing again in this game. I guess the bigger story is the Panthers have to be absolutely panicking and pulling all the fire alarms in the building, and I don't know what they're going to do going forward. Cam Newton ended up coming out of this game late, presumably because it was lopsided and you know, maybe the shoulder was bothering him a little bit, but this offense has looked completely out of sorts, and it just kind of looks like it's not working.
Well, it's early. I don't think anything unexpected is happening. They're still figuring out who they are because they haven't looked stylistically like the offense we expected they would look like with Christian McCaffrey and drafting Curtis Samuel in the second round.
And now Greg Olsen's out.
Well, now Greg Olsen's out. So the one thing they knew they could do, which was stretch the field down the seams and win through formationing with the tight end on the back side of the formation. That's been their staple. That's their go-to. That's their foundation. If things go poorly, that's now gone. So everything is in flux. And keep in mind, the quarterback who's already changing, he's having to change his style of play to address this new offense. He wasn't there in the offseason. He wasn't practicing. He was out injured. So this will probably be the status quo for Carolina for the next at least, I mean, it might be the whole season. And I'd be surprised if it's not, in fact. They're going to have to find other ways to win. What they do have that has carried over, they stole the defense, didn't play well today, but they've got that. And their running game has not changed a whole lot. It's still a gap scheme run game with pull blockers, misdirection, a lot of facets in the ground game. They need, even no matter what they're doing in the passing game, the ground game, that needs to be their foundation. That's when they were great in 2015 when they were doing that. Cam Newton has to be part of that ground game too, Gary. You have to have him in the designs.
Yeah, I mean, look, if the shoulder is bothering him, I think that's kind of the last thing they want to do at this point. But I don't know. Might reach a point where we just don't have a choice anymore.
If he's not running, he's not Cam Newton. So what are you doing anyway then?
Yeah. Jets and Dolphins, this Jets win. I mean, look, we have said mean things about the Jets, and they go out and get a win. And really, it would have been a shutout. The Dolphins end up scoring on literally the last play of the game to make it 20-6 to sort of, I don't know, I guess it's just sort of a very Jetsy thing to happen to the Jets defense, who played great in this game. The Dolphins were horrible in this game. Josh McCown also made a couple of throws, but this was nice for the Jets, and this was sort of a nightmare for the Dolphins. I'm not sure how you size this one up when you go 1-for-12 on third downs, and they really they never got the run game going. Jay Ajayi goes 11 carries for 16 yards. This was as bad as things can get for Miami, and I don't know if this is a sign of things to come.
This is a great illustration of why the NFL, you don't have any idea about it from week to week, because the Jets, the worst part of them the first two games of the season, and this is what was so upsetting, was their run defense, which should not be the worst part. That's the one thing that is stable for them. And the Dolphins ran the ball very well in the first 2 weeks, and that seems to be their profile. And they're bringing Jay Cutler along slowly. They're not asking him to do a whole lot because it's Jay Ajayi's show. Well, Jay Ajayi, they ran the ball 9 times in the first half, and he only gained 16 yards, and then they fell behind in the second half, and they had to throw, and there goes the game, just like that. The Jets dominated them on the ground, in the ground game in the first half, and that was enough to make a blowout for the rest of the game. Tells you Miami's got some limitations on offense to at least either work around or hopefully for them work through. And the Jets are a more capable team, and every team in the NFL is good, because this is not how this game is supposed to go based on what we saw in the first 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Colts and Browns. This was
maybe not. Ooh, I just said every team is good. Oh, boy, that's a tough segue.
Yeah,
there.
This was maybe not a classic here, but look, nice win for the Colts. No Andrew Luck. They were certainly in control in this game. And look, they might be sitting at 2-1 right now if they didn't let that one get away against Arizona in their own building. They looked terrible week one because they turned it over a bunch of times early, but they've been, I'm not going to say they've been good, but they've been kind of a serviceable NFL team since then.
We're waiting on Andrew Luck. And when he comes back, we can go back to talking about the Colts. But right now, they're a team. They won this game. Good for them. And Jacoby Brissett played well. The Colts are not going to be a contender. They're not going to be in the discussion until Andrew Luck's healthy. I know that. I know it worked well today. They're not going to be in the discussion.
All right. One last note before we go ahead to the weekly awards. Obviously, this is a huge story in the league this week, was the demonstrations that went on during the national anthem. This was in response to the comments that President Trump had made during a rally in Alabama on Friday. I'm sure everyone has sort of heard all about this, but it was a different kind of week. Every team handled it a little bit differently. The theme across the league was kind of unity. It's something I didn't know if we'd ever reach a point where the league as a whole would sort of address these sort of underlying issues of activism and some of the social work and community work that some of these players are doing. But yeah, it sort of all came to a head, and I don't think it's a particularly brave thing to come out and say, you know, we condemn President Trump's statements. They're really dumb statements. Even the stuff that some of these guys are advocating for. We at the MMQB, we had a lengthy Q&A with Malcolm Jenkins, who, of course, has been raising his fist before the national anthem is played. It was Malcolm Jenkins and Anquan Boldin, who is now retired and chose not to do any sort of demonstration during the anthem. But they had talked about what some of their goals and some of the specific things they are working on and what they are trying to do to give a little bit of, you know, I think people sort of say like, oh, they're just complaining. They're saying they're oppressed. Well, they're speaking for people who don't have that voice. If you'd like to see the Q&A with Jenkins and Boldin, the article is The Actions Behind the Protests. Jenny Rentis and Kaylin Kaler did the interviews, and it just adds a little more depth to, you know, some of the stuff that sort of gets ignored when everyone says and yells about you're disrespecting this or, you know, that sort of thing. And certainly the anthem means and the flag means different things to different people, and some people are going to be upset by this, but there is a reason behind it, and in my opinion, it's a legitimate reason behind it.
And we haven't talked about this because we're a football show, and I think one of the biggest problems in our country is we have too many opinions out there from people that don't have the right to the – they have the right to the opinion, but they don't know what they're talking about. And a lot of blowhearted stuff gets legitimized because that's what we like to do with these sound-off shows. So I'm always sensitive in contributing to that, and I don't know about this stuff. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a historian. But what's been obvious from the get-go, and it started with Kaepernick, and why I admired the way he went about things so much, is they've been respectful about it. There's been dialogue and discourse, and if you don't like what they're doing, it hasn't been an aggressive or flagrant act. Maybe some see it that way, but the anthem protest, I think you mentioned Malcolm Jenkins, Anquan Boldin, there's been a respectful way. This is how debate should be happening in America, and it doesn't happen. And now that it is, I'm worried that I don't want to contribute to getting it lost in all of the hoopla of the sound bites and the low-hanging fruit that someone says at a rally to get their small base at that rally fired up. I worry that that stuff blurs this whole conversation. I don't want to contribute to that. So that's why I stick to football.
Yeah. No, it's a – and look, hopefully that's the next step is we have a little more of an in-depth conversation about some of the things that players are advocating for. So if you get a chance this week, please look into some of that, you know, as opposed to the shout fest, which kind of dominates everything at all times in this country at this point.
Number 10.
And now the awkward transition to topic number 10. Certainly a little bit lighter here, the weekly awards, which This really is just two guys yelling nonsense at each other. Offensive player of the week. Andy, do you have someone ready to go? I'm still sort of thinking about who I want to give it to.
And see, this is what I like about the weekly award. You're right. This is two guys yelling nonsense to each other. This doesn't matter. That's what's okay about football. This is not an important thing. No one's life and welfare it's not the topic
at hand. Perhaps you're right. Deshaun Watson is going to get trounced in Foxborough, and it doesn't happen. And you know what? Doesn't really matter.
Everyone's still okay. Everyone's still well. My player of the week is Tom Brady, and I might just leave him as my offensive player and unless otherwise noted the way he's playing right now.
All right. I'll give it to Jacoby Brissett. I thought it was a nice win for the Colts. And look, the guy's been there for, what, 3 weeks now, and he almost has two wins in his two starts for the Colts. Yeah, I mean, everything's sort of simplified there, and he's beating the Browns at home is not something that's going to get you a Hall of Fame bust, but he made a couple plays with his legs, had his first career touchdown pass. I thought it was a neat game for him, neat week, so congratulations to Jacoby Brissett, and certainly this is a huge honor for him. Defensive Player of the Week, Andy.
I'll go with William Jackson, the Bengals cornerback. I didn't see every snap, so I mean, I could regret this later, but I wanted to talk about his pick six play on Aaron Rodgers just because I noticed in week one, when Jackson was on the field for a little bit because Pac-Man Jones was suspended, so Jackson was on the field more than he typically is, he has pretty good transitional movement skills. He can get out of his back pedal and get going downhill, and that's the kind of thing that leads to pick sixes on perimeter throws like that one. So just something to keep in mind about William Jackson moving forward. And Adam Jones really has not played well at times this season. He didn't play well in the Houston game at all. So at some point, William Jackson was a first-round pick in 2016. Adam Jones is in his mid-30s, and you don't know what you're going to get from him emotionally either, and that becomes a factor. At some point, maybe we talk William Jackson as the starting right corner in Cincinnati.
Yeah, he's a big guy who moves well. Yeah, I don't know who I want to give Defensive Player of the Week to.
You are overly prepared for this segment I am quite impressed.
There was too much. Whatever. The outline's usually like a couple pages long, and now it's like three times as long because so much stuff happened in the league. I'll give it to Monte Nicholson, even though I couldn't really see what was going on with the Washington secondary on the broadcast angle. But he had the interception to start the game, and he had a nice pass breakup on Michael Crabtree. That was one of those physical plays by a safety, but not being a missile and driving the crown of your helmet into a guy's ear hole type of breakup. Yeah. So I'll give it to Monte Nicholson.
Yeah, he's big. He's athletic. That's an intriguing safety to keep an eye on. Are we doing special teams?
Special teams player of the week. Who you got, Andy?
I've got Jake Elliott. How can you not?
I know. I also have Jake Elliott. You can't pick anyone else. And I tweeted out. Getty had the photo of it was Michael Kendricks and someone else carrying Jake Elliott off the field on their shoulders. After the whole celebration on the field, and like it's a photo. Like I said, I have a soft spot for kickers, and the photo just like it melts my heart, and I was just like grinning like a moron looking at it because it's the shot behind them, and you see like Elliott's he's in like the Rudy pose where he's like he's doing the fist pumps, and you just see the sea of Eagles fans just arms all up and just going nuts, and like I don't know, they're at a rock concert. Or a band that you might really enjoy, like Hoobastank.
I was going to go Matt Prater of the Lions, and because I watching that Detroit game, I thought, man, he made a couple of 50-plus yard kicks. I think one was 57. Thought this guy, this is a difference. I mean, this is field position swings. This makes this team better. And then shortly after I decided I'm taking Special Teams Player of the Week seriously this week, and I'm going to name Matt Prater, then they do the Fox game break, and we see Jake Elliott's 61 yarder, and that was the end of it.
Yeah. See, you're getting into special teams, Andy. Finally. By the way, I like
special teams. Just for the I've told you this 100. I like special teams. I just don't study it on films. And I told you, I don't want to be a blowhard, just contributing loudness to the conversation. So I try to pretend like I don't like it. I guess makes me feel bigger.
And I believe the for Prater, I think the number is 14 straight from 50 plus. He's hit 14 in a row from 50 plus, which is very good. Some good kicking. Who do you have for Coach of the Week, Andy?
Probably would have to go with Greg Minuski, Washington's defensive coordinator, wouldn't you? And I know he was telling Chris Collinsworth it's not about scheme. We're going to have these guys playing fast. And I believe that. I believe Minuski did that, and he got through to the guys. And also, he did have a nice scheme.
Yeah. I was going to give it to Muskie. I'll give it to Bill O'Brien because I was somewhat critical of Bill O'Brien. Not that he cares or not that he should care. But, I mean, look, they went into Foxborough with a rookie quarterback, a raw rookie quarterback, and they came up with a game plan that worked. And like I said, if they convert that third and short, they win the game. And I don't blame him for not, you know, going for the kill shot on fourth down. I think I would have just kicked the field goal there, too, and considering how good the defense had been, sort of dare Tom Brady to go the length of the field in the final 90 seconds or so. But, yeah, I'll give it to Bill O'Brien. He came up with something really good. Like I said, a lot of bells and whistles. We'll see how it goes going forward. But that was a week where it worked for them. And that was a week where it worked for us. That's the end of the show, Andy. That, like I said, that was the NFL at its best this week. That was the most fun and excited I've been about watching football in a long time.
Yeah, fun week, and we have a bunch more of them coming up. That's the cool part.
Absolutely. But for now, we bid you adieu. Thank you, as always, to our researcher, Brett Lieblich, making us sound smart. And, of course, as always, thank you to producer Lou Pellegrino and editor Chris Basil. All those guys over at Cadence 13, formerly Digital Media, by the way. We didn't change companies. But those guys at Cadence 13, always making us sound so good. Most of all, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We really appreciate that you spend your Mondays or you know, if it's Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, but spending time with us. You guys really are the best. Please send us any feedback you might have to make the show better. We would like to hear it. You can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI. We are both on Facebook under our actual human names, or you can write into talkback@themmqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and of course this show, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.